For more information about Yonka Shonibare at African Art, visit their website and check out their special behind-the-scenes blog about the exhibition. Also, their program material is here near the door, so before you leave, please don't forget to pick it up. It's really exciting. Before I introduce Ienka and Karen, I would like to thank Hirschhorn's staff and the staff of the African Museum for making this program possible. It has been wonderful to collaborate with them. I also would like to especially thank Jenny Lihe of Public Programs here at the Hirschhorn Museum, who is always excellent and looks after all the details. I also would like to thank Henry Thagard for his generous support of tonight's lecture. We also would like to thank our members for their continued support. And if you are interested in being a member, please visit our website and find the site which says Join and Engage section. Now to our two speakers. Ienka Shonibare was born in London in 1962 to Nigerian parents, and he was raised biculturally, spending time both in England and in Nigeria. Ienka's work explores contemporary African identity and its relationship to European colonialism through painting, sculpture, installation, and moving image. Shonibare is best known for his work with visual symbols, especially the richly patterned Dutch wax fabric produced in Europe for a West African market that he uses in a wide range of applications. He was shortlisted for the Turner Prize in 2004 and designated a member of the British Empire by Prince Charles in 2005. Dr. Karen Milborn has been curator at the National Museum of African Art since May 2008. Her expertise includes the arts and pageantry of West Zambian and contemporary African art. She is currently developing a major traveling show for the African Museum and a catalog entitled Earth Matters, Land as Material and Metaphor in the Arts of Africa. Before we start the program with Ienka and Karen, I would like to introduce Richard Curran, the Smithsonian Undersecretary for History, Art and Culture, who would like to say a few words. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, and welcome to what I expect will be a wonderful and interesting evening. The other night, Ienka Shonibare, and kind of considering why he got into art in his own humorous style, said, well, because of the girls. I thought that was pretty cool. But of course, there's a lot more than that. And I hope that everyone here has seen or will go see the marvelous exhibition in the National Museum of African Art. Every installation, every turn you take through that exhibition offers a wonderful commentary, insightful perspective that really is quite striking. Ienka's work is here also in the Hirschhorn, just outside the auditorium, and indeed could be many places in the Smithsonian. The fact that his work comments on artistry itself, but also on the nature of the environment, on our history, on our connections between different cultures around the globe, we could even do Ienka Shonibare visits the Smithsonian and have exhibits all over. I'm particularly heartened by the fact that this evening tonight represents a collaboration between the Hirschhorn and the National Museum of African Art. I think it also heightens another connection, which is, of course, the Hirschhorn's devotion to the lives of living artists and the encouragement that our culture only will flourish and survive if we indeed encourage artists to create. And I think the same could be said in African art. While we have marvelous treasures, and you go through the Tishman collection in African art and see the wonders that people really made over centuries and even millennia, it's so heartening to see contemporary African artists who continue to weave their own experience, contemporary experience, into beautiful and profound things for our enjoyment and edification. So that's all I have to say. I'm sure Karen and Inka will say a lot more. Thank you.
As an artist of African origin, there is a way in which one is actually perceived. So in other words, regardless of what I might say, I will be seen in a particular way, you know, whether I want to deal with that or not. So I decided, well, I guess I ought to deal with it. So, and then I went to, there's a market in London called Brixton Market. And, you know, and then I started to talk to them about batik, and I was made to understand that, you know, batik is Indonesian influenced, produced by the Dutch for sales to the African market. And then I did a little more research. I found out that the Indonesians preferred their own batik and they wanted to protect their own markets. So the Dutch tried Africa, and fabrics were successful there. But ironically, after the period of independence, as you'd mentioned earlier, people wanted to be, you know, wear non-European things or Pan-Africanist things. And so the fabrics were kind of adopted in that, you know, and there are factories also making the fabrics in Africa as well. Although I'm made to understand now that the fabrics are produced in China these days. So that's kind of where it all began. And then I had been trained as a painter. So, you know, I'd learned my my modernism. You know, I knew my Barnett Newman, from my Jackson Pollock and all that. So, and then I thought, okay, so where do I fit in into the discourse of kind of, you know, modern art as an artist of African origin? So I started to kind of do abstractions onto the fabric. So, and this is the first piece here, known as Double Dutch.
Out of curiosity, why was it abstract representations on the fabrics?
Because I wanted to, I was thinking about modern art and the history of modernism and this, the historical symbolism of the modern art, often as signifying the kind of male, I guess, heroic painting, you know, usually white male. And at the time, there was a lot of discourse around identity politics, you know, gender, queer politics, you know, civil rights movements, and, you know, the artists in the context of this work, the artists working, I was interested in people like, you know, Nancy Sparrow, Cindy Sherman, Mapplethorpe, Glenn Ligon, Fred Wilson. All of those artists I mentioned were really thinking about, either thinking about race or thinking about gender. And so when I was in school, it's those were the people that you know, I was looking at. And so against that background, because no artist actually works in a vacuum, of course, so, against that background, I was also contemplating issues of identity. So I was reading Edward Said, Orientalism, and also there was, of course, deconstruction. Jacques Derrida was talking about deconstructing the grand narrative, and the status quo was being challenged, if you like, in inverted commas. The people who were outside or who felt that they were outside of the white male establishment was not only challenging the challenge in the hegemony, the dominance of white male culture. So historically, I mean, that is why you will see that I tend to take iconic, iconic imagery, either in art history or even sometimes through literature, through texts, mm-hmm. and I would deconstruct them because that's, the thing that we were all doing at that time, because we were all looking at Jacques Derrida, the French critical theory was the thing that we all looked at, and also Roland Barthes. I was interested in semiotics, semiotics being the theory about signs, about signifiers and signifieds.
Right.
So, and that, well, let's put that in a nutshell, just basically breaking down stereotypes.
Okay.
And so that was the theory of breaking down stereotypes. If I could describe semiotics as that, that's rather simplistic, but anyway, it's looking at the signifiers, and, looking at signs. So there is that very well-known image of Magritte, where you see it's a picture of a pipe, and underneath the pipe it says, "This is not a pipe."
Right.
So the picture of a pipe is not necessarily a pipe. So that the image of the fabric says African, but is it necessarily intrinsically African? So, but anyway, so I guess another way of saying that is what you see is not necessarily what you get.
To continue actually with your earlier comment on working with iconic imagery, with your 2001 painting, The Swing, which of course is modeled after Jean-Honoré Fragonard's 1767 painting, The Swing, you not only have moved the sign from the signifier, but you've broken it right off the canvas and out into three dimensions. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you do choose your subject matter and in particular, as you construct it, I mean, I just have to say, I love the fabric that you chose. You can't see it, but the orange fabric that's pillowing out and is the back of her skirt has the Chanel logo on it. Yeah. I'm wondering if it was perhaps bootlegged. I don't know if you can comment on that, but what could you tell us about how you pick your subjects?
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that I think I find very interesting, or what I like to do really with my art, is that the aspect of frivolity, that aspect of play, mm-hmm. Is very important. And so it's very important that the piece is fun, that it's, even though it might be the carrier of more complex issues, it's very important for me that I have fun when I do the piece. So the fabrics, that particular Chanel fabric, I got from the shop in Brixton. And the interesting thing, actually, there is a backstory to this, because this piece then was shown at the, I was nominated for the Turner Prize.
Yes.
And so this piece was, it was at the Tate Gallery. Mm-hmm. And so there was so much media coverage. It was on television, it was everywhere. And in the shop, I was told that the Chanel people came to the shop to have a quiet word.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But you see, they didn't actually approach me because, I just bought the fabric from the shop. I mean, I didn't copy it, I didn't, I just used it. So. Because the Chanel was kind of concerned that there was no permission, but so when I went back to the shop, I was told to be a little more discreet in the way that I use I use the fabrics.
I did not know that. That's fabulous. Well, in addition to looking at the frivolity of the 18th century, which clearly is expressed to the hilt, in this piece, you've also looked at a more serious side. And in particular, I'm thinking about your recent 2008 series called The Age of Enlightenment, which consists of five different figures, great thinkers from the 18th century, including the physicist, mathematician, philosopher Jean-Laurent d'Alembert, the economist Adam Smith, and as we have here, the chemist Antoine Lavoisier. And I hope you all have already seen this piece as it's right outside the Ring Auditorium. It's now in the permanent collection of the Hirshhorn Museum and will remain on view on Sunday. If you didn't get to see it already today, you should certainly make a point of coming back. But I was hoping that you could talk a little bit about why these five individuals to represent the Enlightenment, and also why you chose to depict them with a disability.
Well, what I have to say is that a lot of my work is actually about, often it's about something that's happening at the moment. You know, it could be something in the news or something happening now. And so when, you know, the Iraq war happened, well, since you know, there's been a lot of talk about taking, you know, democracy to the Middle East, and then there's the idea that, you know, the spread of democracy would somehow, you know, Western democracy would make everything all right. So I drew parallels with the colonialism of the past and the idea of, you know, the Western ideas of enlightenment as a way of civilizing the natives, and then I was also thinking about, you know, sometimes there are many layers in my work. So on top of that, I was also thinking about the tools, because if you think of the Enlightenment then as enabling kind of science, and a lot of the weapons of war came actually out of scientific research. And the weapons of war then can also be, ironically, the Enlightenment itself can produce irrational human ends. So in other words, if you like, the war that we use those tools for become, you know, so that the so-called, you know, rational machines become, they perform irrational acts. So they cease, actually, so there's a kind of a contradiction, because the liberating tools then, you know, then also kill people. Then, of course, that then equates with this notion or this idea that actually to spread democracy, you got to kill a few people, you know. So that's also, but that's not very enlightened. That's a sort of, that's an irrational act. So then in relation to the actual piece, I was then thinking about the figures that represent enlightenment also do have vulnerabilities also. And those vulnerabilities then remove this kind of heroic going out to kind of conquer the world. If you're in effect vulnerable yourself, then with your science, you're not able to kind of, so, It's a, and then it's also an expression of my own physical vulnerabilities as well, if you like. So I don't know, you know, as much as the next person. You know, I do have my own kind of, and I have my own kind of physical vulnerabilities. So the so-called heroic, you know, figure, so supposed to kind of save the world, also have those vulnerabilities as well. So in a way, those champions of reason, if mm-hmm. you like, I've actually shown them in a more vulnerable state. But at the same time, that they're you see, it also depends on the audience, because actually, the fact of their physical disability may say vulnerability, but in fact, depending on who is looking, it may not actually be vulnerability. You see what I mean? So I mean, there are many levels of paradox, I guess. I guess paradox is quite difficult to capture in a work of art. So the question I often get asked by a lot of people mm-hmm. is they tend to have difficulty with the contradictions within my work. Mm-hmm. Because the way the world is constructed is that you're supposed to just have one way of looking at things. Mm-hmm. But my work refuses that. So, and that's very difficult for a lot of people. Because they say, but yeah, but you're saying that, but then you're also saying the opposite at the same time. But I actually think that area in the middle of doubt actually produces, it's the thing that makes it possible to avoid black and whites, which then creates the Holocaust. Now, that's I don't know if you get my meaning.
Absolutely. Logic can lead to illogical conclusions.
Yes. So there is always a questioning internally within the actual ideas or the work. But anyway.
Well, based on what you were saying, actually, on the relationship between your historical subjects sometimes in contemporary politics, I should probably be careful in how I introduce the next image, but I should say for the audience's sake that this really says more about my brain than it does necessarily Yinka's. Also from this series is, as I mentioned, Jean-Laurent d'Alembert, and for those of you who don't recognize, standing next to him is Donald Rumsfeld, who is notorious for always standing at a desk and not wanting to sit down. And so it just led me to wonder how it is you chose or choose how to pose your figures.
Well, I mean, some of that is, you know, if there's a particular figure that I'm wanting to represent. Mm-hmm. Now, you have to understand that represent is not the same as represent.
Okay.
Represent, hyphenated represent. Mm-hmm. So when I represent, I do to the figure what the figure does not hold within itself. So in other words, somebody might say to me, oh, but that particular figure did not have that particular disability. But it is not a representation, it is representation, mm-hmm. quite different. So I may take a photograph of the figure that I'm trying to do something to, mm-hmm. and I may pose like the photograph, but then I may just choose to lie, because as artists we're liars. fiction is...
I thought it was called creative license.
Fiction is my raison d'etre, fiction is my job. So. So in a way, as an artist, I am not. So I'm just kind of emphatically saying this because I do get a bit wary when people say, oh, but this person was not like this, so mm-hmm. why did you do this? Duh. You know.
I think that sums it up. Moving on to another of your grand sculptural tableau, and I have to say that I can only imagine the laughter in your studio as these figures were being created. You've looked at power dynamics in your work, you know, as they relate to gender, to disability, to race, to class, and of course, to sex as well. And I was wondering if you could comment sort of on how you use beauty and humor to tease out these disparities between what people say and what they do.
Yes, I mean, I think that living in Britain, I think, you know, there is something about sort of British humor. I mean, and also historically, if you look at people like, you know, William Hogarth and some of his drawings, because he really poked fun at the aristocracy. Mm-hmm. So a lot of this comes from satire and just basically, you know, poking fun at the establishment, which is a lot of fun. And of course, it's also that fun, that poking fun at the establishment is also about wanting to be a part of the establishment. So the things I actually poke fun at, I also love as well, because mm-hmm. if I didn't love them, I wouldn't give that much attention to it.
You know, they are so luscious, so you've certainly given them attention.
You know, so there is a, you know, so some of the works are essentially, a lot of my work is critique in some kind of way. You know, there is something that I'm critiquing or something that I'm not happy about. But rather than, you know, scream about it, I guess I make art about it. I want people to, you know, to at first, you know, engage and have fun with the pieces, and then maybe they might get to the next level and think, okay, so why has he really done that? You know, so that's kind of where it's coming from.
And I forgot to mention, for those of you who don't know, this piece, of course, was what Yinka created for Documenta in 2002 for that very well-known art fair that occurs in Kassel, Germany. So it had a grand presence there and, of course, has continued to tour. But we're quite excited that, as part of the retrospective, the pieces have been reassembled.
Yeah, I mean, I can also explain further. I mean, this piece is called Gallantry and Criminal Conversation. And I learned that criminal conversation in the 18th century is what you would be accused of if you had an affair. Mm. And also, a lot of members of the aristocracy used to go to places like Venice on the Grand Tour to learn about culture, essentially. And people actually ended up going to, you know, people had extramarital affairs, I suppose, and they did things they couldn't necessarily do at home. And of course, that's also happening today as well, in terms of kind of sex tourism and so on. So,
well, as we say in the United States, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas.
Well, exactly. So exactly. So, and usually the privilege of the wealthy as well, you know. So, and so it's kind of along those lines.
It's interesting to me, too, because, of course, the figures are fully clothed. You don't ever actually see anything. And that strikes me as, your newest work. And what I'm showing here is two works from an exhibition that Yinka just opened last month. So these pieces are currently on view at the Stephen Freeman Gallery in London. And that teasing, suggestive, but never quite revealed quality. You're using nudity. The violence is apparent. I was curious as to why.
Well, this piece is the whole, is that the only image you have? It's somewhat confusing.
Unfortunately, I do. So these are from a body of works that Yinka has done that, you will talk about why you chose Willy Loman as a subject, but Willy Loman, of course, is the main character from Arthur Miller's 1949 Pulitzer Prize-winning play, The Death of a Salesman. So I do apologize, I don't have the full series.
Okay, no, that's fine. So, the exhibition, it's actually in London now. It closes on the 20th of November, I think, at Stephen Friedman Gallery. And the exhibition is called Willy Loman, The Rise and Fall. And I was thinking, really, I mean, just generally thinking about the credit crunch, actually. Mm-hmm. And so when you enter this space, what you see is the Willy Loman character from Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman. And he is in a crashed car, because, of course, the original character crashed his car for the insurance money, mm-hmm. you know, for his children. But he was a failed salesman, really, kind of, you know, rather like some of the Wall Street guys who don't really have a clue about the financial instruments that they're kind of working with. So, and the whole thing sort of went pear-shaped. And so in a sense, so you see this character, you see this crashed car, but then you see these large photographs on the wall, and they depict him on the other side. So he's in, you see him in different stages of Dante's Inferno, so Dante's hell. Mm-hmm. And in Dante's Inferno, there are different punishments for different types of crimes. So there is, so the series goes, so there's in avarice, and then you see the, you know, the people pushing, all these nude people are kind of pushing money bags, and then I think what you have there is the gluttons.
Yes.
So they're like pig's heads and so on. And then you've got the thieves as well on one side, which is all these people are being kind of strangled by snakes. And the Willy Loman character is there. So when I was shooting that in my studio, I had like, and I had about 30 snakes or something all running around when I was shooting that. And then the snake handlers were like running after them. It was quite a fun shoot, you know. But, you know, so, I mean, that's kind of what that, you know, the show that's on at the moment. So that's kind of more or less what that's about, yeah.
Okay. And of course, those photographs that you were just describing are by no means your first foray into photography. In particular, the use of your own image within photographs. And what we're seeing here is the 2001 series, Dorian Gray, based on both the Oscar Wilde 19th century novel and the 1945 MGM film called The Picture of Dorian Gray. And in this body of work, I mean, you can see how your interest in the dandy and theatricality and representation all coalesce. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you determined the design and casting and pace of your own depiction of this work of literature and film.
Well, I mean, I was actually, I was thinking about, I mean, this work is kind of quite personal, I think. It's the first time I've really, you know, contemplated or thought about, you know, the body and my own disability and, you know, because I mean, some of you know this, I got a virus in my spine when I was 19. Which left me completely paralyzed, and then I gradually, you know, recovered from that. And so, you know, the figure, the Dorian Gray figure in the picture of Dorian Gray, he, you know, his picture was painted by a painter, and over time, the picture stayed young, and then he stayed young, and the picture got older and more grotesque, and he just looked younger and younger. And, you know, so, and I was, you know, thinking really about the, my own mortality, really, and my own kind of struggles with my body over time as well. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's a film that also I'm very intrigued by. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to sort of do, I guess, put myself in Dorian Gray's, you know, in just play the kind of Dorian Gray character myself. And so, I mean, I don't quite know what you want to know, really, but it's more
or less. It's also interesting to me how you choose the faces of the others. And you did distill, you know, a larger narrative and a larger film into 12 images. So, you know, I was curious a little bit about your own process of storyboarding.
Well, I mean, I think I just took significant moments in the story. Mm-hmm. You know, when his portrait was painted, when he fell in love with the actress Sybil Vane, who then committed suicide because he wouldn't marry her because she was of a different class. You know, so I was also intrigued by those storylines, and then of course the image of the painter who painted him, and then his assassination of the painter. So when he was disturbed by this grotesque image, yeah.
I guess it also leads me to ask the question, what is a day in the work life of Yinka Shonabari MBE like?
Well, I think the great thing about, I guess, choosing to be an artist is that, you know, it's always changing, it's always varied. And as you can see, I work in different ways, so it depends. I have periods in which I actually want to work with a lot of people. So, mm-hmm. I'm auditioning actors and making storyboards or whatever. But then sometimes at the moment, actually, for the most part, I'm doing drawing, mm-hmm. Because in my, in the new show in London, I'm showing works on paper for the first time. And, you know, so it varies. I mean, it goes, you know, there might be a period where I just want to be intimate, you know, in my studio. We just want to draw, and I don't really want to be involved with a lot of people. But then it changes again if I'm doing a photo shoot or a film shoot or whatever, then I'm on location, you know, so.
Okay.
It depends on what I'm doing, really.
I want to allow enough time for the audience to ask questions, too. If we have time, I'd wanted to ask you about your first cinematic work and your influences like Greenaway, Godard, René, as well as the relationship between painting and film. But since you were just talking on photographs, or I mean on drawing, I'm going to skip ahead to your recent works that you have turned to works on paper. And I thought perhaps you would want to talk a little bit more about your recent body of work.
Yeah, I mean, what you see there is a piece called, Climate Shit Drawing. Mm-hmm. I did a series on that. And that image up there is actually the image of shit, you know. And then I've got bits of Financial Times and sort of doodles and text and, you know, so, yeah.
But then I'll go back and give you the chance to answer my question about perhaps some of your thoughts about the relationship between film and paint.
The kind of films, you know, that I've looked at when I was doing this one, I looked at a number of films that I liked very much, and they sort of inspired me. There's a film called The Russian Ark that I like very much. And that film was done in one take. And it's a film that takes you through the Hermitage in Russia. Is it the Hermitage? And it's a very beautiful film. And then Peter Greenaway's The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and the Lover. This film is based on Verdi's opera. Mm-hmm. It's based called Mbalo in Mascara, mm-hmm. and it's based on the story of, again, you know, this was done during the Iraq War. The film is based on Gustav III, of Sweden, you know, and he was fighting wars in Russia and in Denmark, and his people were starving, and he liked going to the ball, and he was assassinated, you know, at one of the balls. And I thought it was an intriguing story, but I changed the king into a woman, and I changed the killer into a woman as well. I just wanted to change the kind of roles that we are familiar with in regular kind of cinema. Mm-hmm. You know, so actually, you know, gender politics, you know, plays into the, even the casting when I was casting. Mm-hmm. So there, you know, there are kind of subtle things that I, you know, political things or whatever that sort of happen in the making or how things are done, and the film uses a lot of kind of repetition as well. So the king is shot, the king dies, but then there's a possibility for redemption, perhaps, you know, the king gets up again and he dies. But also the device for that repetition, it's more to do with you know, when you go into a museum and you watch the video, mm-hmm. it usually goes on a loop. And what I wanted to do was to have the actors reenact the idea of the loop, so that when you see it the second time, the action is slightly different. It's not the same as the, you know, so the actors have to repeat. And you know, again, you know, metaphorically speaking, you know, history repeats. Mm-hmm. As well, and then of course I wanted it to be a kind of, you know, mesmerizing, hypnotic imagery, you know, mm-hmm. kind of compelling imagery. I guess one way of saying this is that I make the art that I want to see, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, if I want to see something, and I don't see that anyone else is making it, then I'll make it. So for the most part, you know, I'm making the art for myself.
Which then leads me to your next, my last question. If it, oops, go back. Let's see. Which is, I know that that Anne-Marie, your studio manager, has bought out the gift shop at the Air and Space Museum. So I was hoping that you might tell us a little bit about where you're going from here.
Well, I mean, I've made, I'm very interested in, as you know, a lot of my work does deal with the issue of colonialism, which is why, of course, I was, you know, paradoxically quite excited when I, you know, when I was made a member of the Order of the British Empire. you know, space travel is another kind of colonialism, if you like. It's the next frontier. And so I am intrigued by science fiction and space travel. So, and I'm going to be doing a new series of works for a show in Australia related to that subject matter. But I have in the past, if you look in the catalog, touched on that subject matter a little bit.
Yeah. Absolutely, one of my all-time favorite pieces is Vacation, actually.
All right.
So, well, before I turn this over to the audience, I want you all to know that, of course, you can come see Black Gold, Mbalo and Mascara, The Swing, the Dorian Gray series. All of these works are on view through March 7th at the National Museum of African Art. So make sure you go to see Strange Bodies and make sure you come down the street to see us. And then Milena, if you would take over for the questions, or what's the... Okay. There's one on this side. No, there's a questioner over here. Okay, sorry.
Come. Can you open the water for?
Do you make the pieces yourself, or do you have a team of people?
I'll tell you when I go.
Or help you with them, or how are they made?
No, I don't. As an artist, I don't work. Other people do that. Yes. Yeah.
I love that you're in a lot of photographic images.
What for me is social commentary, but it's also very personal. You know, not only your opinion, but that you are in it. Can you say a little bit about that? If you feel like it.
What do you want me to say?
What inspired you or what happened? What did come to mind when I say that?
I guess, you know, it's cheaper to employ myself. Some pieces I make because, if it's about me, I guess I should be in it. So that's it, really. I mean, there's nothing more to it. No, I mean, you're absolutely correct. I think, sometimes people do overanalyze. That's not to say that the work is not serious. I mean, the work is serious, but because I'm an artist, really. I'm not an art historian, and I'm not an academic, so I can be more frivolous and whimsical. And usually academics, not whimsical. But that's just me stereotyping.
We do have one question that was actually emailed that I'll ask while the mic goes back. Yinka, have you ever closed your eyes and imagined yourself wearing not the black suits of Dorian Gray, but one cut from Dutch wax batiks? In your imagination, where would you be seen wearing it, and what would you be doing?
That's private.
Yes. Yeah.
So I was just wondering if you've ever been inspired by one of those artists.
The artist you mentioned, when I lived in Nigeria, I saw that there were artists and it was possible to be, to do that profession. So if I haven't been influenced directly by them, certainly when I was a lot younger living in Nigeria, they gave me a sense that being an artist was an option that I could take up. So in that sense, they were my role models in that sense.
Thanks.
Many of the figures in your sculptures don't have heads. They're rendered headless, and I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on that choice, if it has to do with maybe offering multiple identification or a sense of alienation or maybe...
Well, I mean, that headlessness thing, I mean, that kind of started off as a joke about the French Revolution. When they had their heads chopped off. And also on another level, I mean, if you look closely at my figures, they are actually of mixed heritage. So they're neither black nor white. And I thought that actually removing the face would remove racial specificity. So, but gosh, that's a difficult word to say, specificity. As a Yoruba speaker, my tongue doesn't carry that word very well. Anyway, so we'll remove a racial specificity. And I think that, but that said, it's also a way to remove any kind of stereotyping. So, and so, you know, so metaphorically, I was doing something I had described in the past as being post-racial. So challenging this idea of a fixed race removes the possibility of oppression or stereotyping. Yeah. So actually, I do make serious things about serious, serious work about serious issues. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, headless man trying to drink kind of makes me chuckle sometimes. And I think, don't laugh at your own jokes. That's not good. Yeah.
I was wondering if about the piece, The Gallantry and Criminal Conversation, and I think it was referred to this evening as a tableau. And the way it's installed in this exhibition strikes me clearly as a tableau, like a grouping of figures that belong together in this group. And yet, I think if I, when I looked at the text for the individual pieces, that it seems like they're all in different collections now. And I was just curious about that, if you could comment that. Was it more of a series, like the Age of Enlightenment, where they're discrete figures that aren't necessarily displayed together, or was it actually envisioned as a tableau? And if so, if there's any story behind why the pieces are now separated and reunited for the exhibition, or what the situation is with that?
Well, I mean, I guess artists are sort of high maintenance, and if you make a piece that big, you're not going to find a single collection that's going to buy it. So you make a choice. Do I sell or not? So, I mean, it's a very practical thing. We had an agreement with the various people who collected the pieces that, you know, that whenever we show, they will lend to the show. So in other words, it's been broken down into different collections because it's actually quite difficult to sell such a large piece to one collection, you know. So that's, you know, I'm sorry, it's not a more complex reason, you know. It's just practical, you know. Yeah, but it is one piece, though.
Is it okay if I ask my question now? Oh, okay. The young lady in the back asked the question about the headlessness of your figures. That was going to be my question, and I'm glad she did, because she added nuances that weren't in my brain yet. I was going to just ask you, when was the aha moment that you thought of doing that? But my other question is, and I love the ironies in the work, my other question is there a circumstance in which you would consider putting heads on a figure, and if so, what might that be?
Well, when they are real people in my photographs, I tend not to chop their heads off. And I'm sure you can understand that. It might get me into trouble. So, you know, yeah.
I don't know. Oh, I guess it's working. Follow up also on the headless issue. You had mentioned they were headless and you made them, that sort of erased the idea of race. But they're a cinnamon color, the figures themselves in your tableaus, when the actual figures have this color to them.
I'm sorry, I didn't get that.
The figures in each tableau, the pigment of the skin is a cinnamon, deep brown.
It's a cinnamon color.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Is there a racialization applied by your choice of color?
Shoot me.
I
It's a color.
Okay, yeah. Okay. But it's, it has a message, I guess.
Well, I mean, as I said earlier, you know, I wanted something that could pass for both black or white, right? So maybe the color I chose didn't work out. I don't know, but I didn't want to fix a kind of a very clear black and white thing. And that's the way I chose to do it, I guess.
I have a question over here. I went and visited your show at the Museum of African Art today, and I liked there was a fun little corner where you had your playlist and you had the video of Dorian Gray playing. Was that your idea or was that the curator's to put that together?
The video of Dorian, oh, well, that's the education. Yeah, you mean here,
that's
right?
The education part?
Yeah, yeah. So
oh, it was fun.
I wanted to know if you have taken any of your sculptures to the continent of Africa, and if you have, what has been the reception for them?
If I had taken any of them to Africa?
Yes, I think you're Ghana.
Okay. Yes, I mean, I've done exhibitions in Ghana, South Africa, but not Nigeria yet. I mean, I get, you know, I just do the exhibitions that I get invited to do, I guess. So, and so I've been invited to do shows in South Africa and in Ghana. Yeah. Okay, thank you. Yeah.
Good evening. You were talking a lot about frivolity and play in the work, and sort of piggybacking off of this question about the headlessness and the color of skin. I wonder a lot about the role of imagination, because I connect that with play and frivolity. So I wonder about the message of the imagination of race and how that plays out in the way that the figures are placed and what they are doing, and also the role of sex and power and the placement of the bodies.
Yeah, I'm sorry. No, hold on, don't take the... you know, there's a lot in what you said, right? It's actually... So can you be more specific?
So with the piece on criminal conversation,
yes.
Sort of my thought is when I hear about the skin color to some people not seeming ambiguous about race, that to me signals that there is an imagined color of what we are supposed to be. So imagining that a particular color must belong to a certain race, to me, is where you fit on the spectrum. So I could look at the skin color and not necessarily identify it as either black or white, but perhaps in our culture where we're taught to look at brown skin and assume and give a racial designation to it, the imagination tells us a story about what the skin color looks like. And then that, for me, connects also to sort of the sexualization of those bodies and how we imagine the bodies being sexualized and what added meaning that gives.
Well, you know, I like your comments very much. And the reason I like your comments is that your comments really, you know, your comments have actually explained why I do what I do, because there is the politics of race or racial politics is so fraught There is a lot of historical pain attached to notions of race and the politics of inequality and so on. So it's a very complex area. And I think that by removing faces, sort of saying, you know, this is a generic person. So that, but the interesting thing about the readings, what I find interesting, what I'm doing is actually, what I'm doing in that sense is irrelevant. What is actually relevant is the baggage that people bring into their viewing of my work. And that baggage is an expression of a historical problem that we have all inherited. So I enjoyed your comments.
Based on that positive note, yeah.